This week on Making Contact.
Another racist outcome of how stories are covered is that people walk around with no understanding of the roots of the social problem.
We're interested in communication rights to advance racial, gender, and economic justice. The goal is to create a media system that increases justice.
Racial bias, underrepresentation, lack of access. These are just a few concerns of media justice activists. Confronted with the ever-increasing concentration of media and the tossing away of FCC regulations ensuring diversity on the airwaves, under-resourced communities are getting organized. On this edition, we'll take a look at media justice and the grassroots efforts to make media more accountable. I'm Pauline Bartolone, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Holding media accountable for racial bias and underrepresentation is one of the main concerns of media justice activists. Whether it's what's in the news or what's left out, communities of color, women, and low-income people say discrimination is inherent in mainstream media. One example is the case of a popular radio station in New York City. Less than 1 month after the tsunami devastated Southeast Asia in late 2004, MS Broadcasting affiliate Hot 97 repeatedly aired a racist parody called the Tsunami Song, sung to the tune of We Are the World. Leanne Stanky has more about the community mobilization against the song.
There were Africans drowning.
Little tournament swept away.
You could hear God laugh and swim, you bitches, swim.
When New York City hip-hop station Hot 97 aired the Tsunami Song, a racist parody of the late December disaster that killed nearly 200,000 people, listeners were outraged.
I was really shocked at first, and I just didn't know how to react to it. And I just, like, you know, shook it off at first. But then when you keep listening to the lyrics, and, like, it's all over the internet, too, and you're just, like, hit with this, and you're like, no, this is not right.
You better run or kiss your ass away. Go find your mommy.
I just saw her float by, a tree right through her head.
I heard it on the radio, and I thought it was disgusting. What I found amazing was that I heard it in a car radio, and the minute I got out of the car, people were actually talking about it in the activist world, and it was just like a ripple of outrage across many different sectors.
The first wave of outraged public response was immediately seen online. Hip-hop writer Jay Smooth was one of the first to break the story. Smooth is host of one of New York City's longest-running hip-hop radio shows, The Underground Railroad.
Well, a friend of mine let me know that they were playing this extremely offensive song, the so-called Tsunami Song. So I made a post about it on my website and posted about it on a couple of other sites, and it spread like wildfire immediately after that. People picked up on it on lots of other weblogs and websites. And by the next morning, it had spread so far that the radio station had already issued an apology and taken it off their website.
The Tsunami Song first aired on January 18, 2005, and was played on Hot 97's Miss Jones in the Morning show for four consecutive days. On-air personality Todd Lynn and producer Rick Delgado wrote the racially charged lyrics. Morning show host Tarsha Jones, known as Miss Jones, contributed to the vocals. Hot 97's initial apology was considered weak because the host did not issue an on-air apology. The station's waffling response included removing the song from their website, but continuing to play it on the morning show for two additional days. Employing the global reach of the World Wide Web, thousands called for advertisers to boycott the station. Jay Smooth again.
And I got a list of everyone who advertised on their website and radio station. It was McDonald's, Pepsi, Toyota, Sprint. There was a long list of all the big corporations that would be advertising. And I put up all the phone numbers of the executives, all the email addresses, and I was getting up to 100,000 visitors a day on my site because of this issue, so they were all getting bombarded with complaints, and after the next few days, you saw almost all the major sponsors dropping out.
The boycott campaign was successful. Toyota, McDonald's, and Newsday temporarily pulled their ads. Sprint pulled their spots and pledged not to advertise for all of 2005. This satisfied some, but many, including music promoter and activist Hugh Savior, felt that those who continued to broadcast and defend the song should be held responsible.
I was offended not only by the playing of the song, but the conversation that went on in and around the song when a sister stood up, Miss Info, and said she didn't want to be a part of it, and then she was attacked.
That song is really offensive to me, and I opted not to involve myself.
But why do you always have to try, like, if you feel that way, then why are you even on the show? Like, you always have
because
to separate
I support,
yourself.
Nah, because I
Morning show host Miss Jones was not only disparaged for her participation in the creation and broadcast of the song, but also for berating fellow hosts Miss Info, the only Hot 97 morning personality who publicly objected to the parody.
No, I'm trying to.
No, you're not. You're not. You're always trying to undermine everything that's done here.
That is so ridiculous.
Okay, well, you guys have a nice day. We appreciate.
According to the Daily News, Miss Info, who is Asian American, is considering a lawsuit in response to the treatment she received from coworkers, such as Todd Lynn. After one of their heated on-air discussions, Lynn commented that he was going to start shooting Asians. Lynn's defense of the song only enraged the hip-hop community more. Chinese-American rapper Jin freestyles his response.
Uh-huh. When was hip-hop about being racist and being ignorant, huh?
So we're gonna take a
Tell
minute.
Tell me that. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. I'm only gonna say this once.
Once.
Yeah. Somebody gotta say it.
Word.
Check it. Talk to him. You got it twisted. If you think I'm here to cock block on a bunch of no talent wannabe shock jocks,
nah.
And they say it's all freedom of speech. Well, you just lost yours. Read them and weep. Won't be happy till you're fired. My people's is pissed homes. And I bet you not a soul will miss Jones. Miss who?
Public outcry came to a head 10 days after the song first aired. On January 28, 2005, one of the coldest days of the year, hundreds of concerned citizens from as far away as California demonstrated outside of Hot 97's corporate offices. Rally organizer and New York City Council member John Liu called on Indianapolis-based Emmis Broadcasting to take the song's producers off the air.
But it's much, much more than these two people. It is about Emmis Communications themselves. This company that has for so long fomented an atmosphere that aided and abetted, encouraged in every way, the production of this most awful, hateful programming.
Just 3 days after John Liu spoke at the rally, Todd Lynn and producer Rick Delgado were fired. Miss Jones was fined, temporarily suspended, but soon reinstated. Her salary during the suspension period was donated to tsunami relief, as was an additional $1 million. More recently, a coalition that formed in response to Hot 97's racist practices, Reach Hip Hop, as well as a group called Asian Media Watch, have issued Emmis a list of demands. The demands include permanently removing Miss Jones, proving that the station has fulfilled its pledge to donate $1 million to tsunami relief, and immediately ceasing and desisting all use of the N-word. The coalition also demands that Emmis initiate diversity trainings. These demands are backed by a huge number of musicians, including Black Wax recording artist and activist Nana Soul. Soul says Hot 97 has been airing racially inflammatory programming for years. She has been organizing the African American community in response to the song.
The general idea has been that this is somehow, you know, specifically offensive to Asian people because it talked about, you know, the tsunami disaster. But what you find is that people all across all types of cultural lines are offended by it because of what it represents. But also what was really significant was that, you know, Hot 97 has a history of doing this kind of thing and using, you know, racist elements to boost their, you know, their ratings. And they've specifically, Black people have been the butt of this. So we've been, you know, fighting against Hot 97 for quite some time. So the tsunami song is nothing new for us.
Although the conflict between Hot 97 and community members is not over, DJ Cotton Candy compares their success so far to the story of David and Goliath.
They're not as large as you think they are. Yes, they are in the fact that they have money and they have all these stations across the world, but the voices of the people are definitely larger. And I've learned that as an activist throughout the years, but when you're fighting something this large and actually see them crumble and actually see these companies and sponsors actually pull out and listen to us, that means something, and it's inspiring.
Hip-hop writer Jay Smooth credits the success of the campaign to grassroots organizing.
The most beautiful thing about this to me was that it really didn't involve any established organizations or coalitions. It was something that just came out spontaneously and organically through regular people that came to my website through the internet. And that's the most impressive thing about it to me, is it shows how the internet can just give a voice to regular people and empower them to speak out before organizations and politicians step into it.
But you know, I got love for everybody, whether you black, white, Hispanic. That's why I love hip-hop, because it brings us all together.
In New York City, I'm Leanne Stanky for Making Contact.
This is next time, making fun of their tragedies. So yo, keep them emails going through, man. Keep them complaint letters going out.
Initiatives are popping up all over the country under the name of Media Justice. Organizations like the Media Alliance in Oakland, California, are working to get broadcast licenses in underserved communities. The Center for Rural Strategies in Whitesburg, Kentucky, managed to stop a reality TV show called The Real Beverly Hillbillies, what the center called a classist portrayal of the rural poor. Yet other groups have begun making their own media.
Finalists gave the performances of their lives to stay on this stage.
In April 2004, middle school students in a media analysis project in Harlem watched Fox 5 TV for a half an hour each night. They watched commercials, wrote about the content, and produced a radio segment as their final project.
Transformations ever brought to television.
The Swan commercial is bad because it could hurt those women's feelings, because it's trying to tell them that they're ugly. It's not safe to do so many surgeries on your body because it could make a damage on you.
The students were part of a project called Radio Roots. They found, for instance, that more dogs appeared in the Fox commercials than people of color.
Next on Fox.
This is not what the media is supposed to be doing. The media is supposed to educate us and tell us important things we need to know. How come you always see white people in commercials? They're not the only race in this world. How come you never see teens in commercials or disabled people? They watch TV too.
The Radio Roots Project is one of dozens of youth media initiatives in under-resourced communities around the country that help young people understand media messages. These programs, like Youth Radio in Berkeley, California, train young people how to produce media themselves so that issues important to them reach a wider audience.
That's Hong there. So this is basically where all of the web design training happens here.
McCray Parker of Youth Radio gives me a tour of their facilities. They have a newsroom, website editing stations, a full production studio, and even video trainings. For over a decade, teenagers here have been producing radio stories for a national audience.
This is the practical. This is the lab, you know, doing the policy, doing, you know, curriculum development. It's good. We need the research. We need the advocacy. But this is really where it hits the road. You know, what we're looking at now is an environment where, you know, media is concentrated, it is consolidated, also to a certain degree censored. And with those decreasing opportunities to actually get, you know, diverse perspectives out there, you know, into the airwaves, a place like Youth Radio serves a great purpose in that it does allow young people a way to get their perspectives, their responses to what's going on in the world, out to the world.
That's the sound of the revolving door between the U.S. and Mexico. Because we're young and we're living here in the border, we have access to a lot of things.
When people first catalyze and tell their own stories and then come away with their own media product, there's something that's really invigorating about that.
Thenmori Soundararajan is director of Third World Majority, a media production and resource center in Oakland. She says training young people in making their own media is a crucial part of media justice.
Because they've been able to create something like in the back room in this like small rickety little digital storytelling workshop for like something that's under like about $100 that's more compelling to them, that's more real to their realities than something that they would see on WB or NBC or any other cable channels. And when they see that kind of relationship and recognize, well, wait a minute, well, why aren't I on my local station? Well, what is going on here? People start to question, people start to really think about what their agency is, and I think become really catalyzed around the movement for media justice.
An essential part of the job, says Soundararajan, is teaching the principle that communication is a human right.
A lot of people don't know or don't care about their right to communicate because the relationship with media, as it's set up by the corporations, is very much a passive relationship. You consume, but you don't produce. And I think the role of people who are cultural trainers, who are video trainers, is to switch that dynamic up by actually starting with folks being able to learn how to create media and discover their agency in that.
But Elana Rosen of the national media literacy group called Just Think says teaching production skills is not enough. Rosen says understanding mainstream media messages must go hand in hand with production. So she's trying to get media education curricula in schools across the country.
We know that there's a multi-billion dollar industry that survives on selling young people junk. So when young people understand that there's a market driving them to believe in certain values that are not created from their own consciousness, their own thought process, that it's basically just a business, then they suddenly turn the power around.
Rosen says media literacy gives young people the freedom to make responsible choices in the face of an advertising industry that targets children.
And once they realize that they have some power around buying those products and that they can put those companies out of business by abstaining from buying from those products, they finally have a voice and realize that they'll be listened to. And those are the stepping stones to the kind of social justice that this work supports.
In fact, say organizers like Malkia Cyril of the Oakland-based Youth Media Council, young people should be at the forefront of media justice.
Those who care about justice need to also care about whether or not young people become leaders for justice or become soldiers for war. You know, that matters. So our effort is to create organizers who care about justice, who care about fairness, who care about equality.
There are no television commercials for schools and their education, and it makes me feel like they should start airing commercials based on schools and what kind of schools and how we can improve our community.
We'll have more about media justice in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit us on the web at radioproject.org. In September 2002, media activists converged on the Highlander Institute in Newmarket, Tennessee. Their goal was not only to discuss problems in the mainstream media, but also to look at new approaches to media reform. Malkia Searle, director of the Oakland-based Youth Media Council, was one of the participants. She says the media reform movement only benefits those already privileged in society.
They came together basically because they were tired of the current model that the media reform movement was using, primarily lobbying, under the leadership of lawyers, under the leadership of folks that were primarily white men, with goals that did not achieve media rights for all or communication rights for all, but continued to achieve and expand the rights of those whom were already in power. And these groups of people were coming together saying, but wait, we need to produce a model that actually produces changes that are relevant for these other constituencies.
The new framework for change was called media justice. It's a broad concept that goes beyond reforming the media. It's a space for organizing and debate within communities of color, women, low income, and queer people about how to use media to change society.
We're not interested in communication rights simply for the sake of communication rights. We're interested in communication rights to advance racial, gender, and economic justice. That's the key difference between media policy reform and media justice organizing. The goal is to create a media system that increases justice.
Cyril and other media justice organizers say the movement should be led by marginalized people themselves, who have historically been excluded and discriminated against by the mainstream media.
The basic problem is that the mainstream media is market-driven.
Makani Temba-Nixon of Washington, D.C.-based Praxis Project is part of the Media Justice Network. She says the mainstream media's exclusion of non-white people is rooted in commercialism and has racist outcomes. One example is commercial media's reporting of isolated incidents.
Because folks aren't looking at patterns of racism, patterns and of how structures work to oppress folk, they're focused on the story in the present with very little history. And so another racist outcome of how stories are covered is that people walk around with no understanding of the roots of the social problems. And so they tend to blame the individuals. And that blame isn't something abstract. It's that sort of blame and then hatred results in why a black man like Amadou Diallo would find himself getting shot at with a wallet in his hand instead of a gun, because the imagery then becomes literally life-threatening.
In 1964, Reverend Everett Parker of the United Church of Christ studied local broadcast media in Jackson, Mississippi. He found that little attention was given to the black community, and when they did refer to black Americans, it was derogatory. Blacks did not have the opportunity to buy airtime for commercials or political advertisements. So Parker took his findings to the Federal Communications Commission, saying Jackson's broadcast media violated the Fairness Doctrine, a loose set of laws which, until it was repealed by the Reagan administration, required local TV stations to cover controversial stories in a fair and balanced way. The FCC told Parker he had no legal standing, but Parker did not give in so easily. Mark Lloyd is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of an article called Communications Policy is a Civil Rights Issue. Lloyd says Reverend Parker's work in Mississippi was the beginning of a struggle to change the media so that it better serves people of color and women. I talked with Lloyd about the Parker case and how well the mainstream media today serves marginalized communities.
What Parker did was took the FCC to court and said, it doesn't make sense that you give out a license to a local television station with the obligation that they're supposed to serve the local community, but then tell the local community that the local community has no right to go to the FCC to complain about what the local TV station is doing. So as a result of that, the Court of Appeals it created the ability for local citizens to have standing and complain about what local television stations and radio stations were doing in the local community. And this changed the course of communications law in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Even though the Fairness Doctrine was in place before then, the fact of the matter is citizens had no real access to complain about whether or not they were being treated fairly or not. And the FCC, as a result of this, had to put in several laws about how local stations were supposed to ascertain local community interests. They put in laws regarding equal employment opportunity, which increased the number of women at local stations just tremendously over the years. They began ultimately to look at ownership issues and what the barriers were to ownership. But all of that occurred because of this one case.
So you mentioned the Fairness Doctrine before. Can you tell us about media policies regarding diversity and when those started to be rolled back?
Well, the rollback for public interest communications policies really began in the mid-1980s and continued through today and continued to some extent with the 1996 Telecommunications Act. But before the 96 Act occurred, we had the elimination of something called ascertainment, the requirement of broadcasters to go to local communities to find out what issues were important in those local communities and to report to the FCC about what they had found. That was eliminated in 1984. There was something called the NAB Code of Conduct that was eliminated around 1984, 85, that were essentially was a self-policing policy by the National Association of Broadcasters. and the Reagan Justice Department determined that it was a violation of antitrust law. And there began a rollback of equal employment opportunity laws, again, under the Reagan administration in the mid-80s. Now, what the 1996 Act did was essentially allow greater media consolidation, which is a little different than the accountability of local broadcasters to local communities. It just sort of allowed one owner to own more media properties than ever before.
So in your article, you say television, since its inception, has underserved the Black community. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, all media in this country, but particularly broadcast media, was established at a time when all non-white Americans, and actually most women, had very few protected legal rights in this country. As a result of that, various policies were developed that put essentially white Americans in a very protected position vis-a-vis broadcast stations. White Americans own and control 98% of all federal licenses to all broadcast operations in the United States. If this were South Africa, if this were any other country, and you saw roughly a third of the population licensed to 2% of the resources, we would be shocked and dismayed and quite concerned about that situation. But again, that is the situation in the United States. It is not because there are, I don't think, deliberate policies in place now. It's because historical patterns have established this incredible inequality in the ability to communicate messages, again, among ourselves and to other Americans. As a result of this, we end up in a situation where we don't know the problems and challenges that a variety of the communities living in the United States face.
So how would you suggest going about changing the media climate so that it's more just and fair for everyone? I mean, do we need to change policies or take a more cultural approach, like through media literacy programs?
Well, one leads to the other. I don't think you get a more media literate society without policies that promote those things. And this is the challenge. In the absence of an intelligent discussion about some of the core issues, it is very, very difficult to fix the problem. The first challenge in any effort to change anything in a democratic society is to make sure that we have the ability to communicate what the problems are effectively. If we don't understand how important media is, we cannot solve any other problem that this society faces. And that means changing the policies so that we can get more views on the air, so that not one interest is able to dominate our discussion in the United States. And unfortunately, the internet is not enough. New technology by itself has never solved the problem of media. It really takes changing the fundamental rules.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Kimberly Ross for production assistance, Robert Frazier, and Appleshop. Music by Kevin Moore. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a cassette or CD copy of program number 1905, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, office manager, Tom Evans, development associate, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Bartomeon, national advisor. And I'm your host and associate producer, Pauline Bartolone.